everyone. Welcome. It is Your Money. I'm Susie Jones. Happy to have you with us today to talk more about your investments, particularly your portfolio in the world of inflation. We have, as always, every week, Bruce Helmer, the founder of Wealth Enhancement Group and a financial advisor, as well as Peg Webb, senior vice president and financial ice financial officer. I'm sorry, you guys. Good morning. Welcome to both of you.
Good morning, Susie. Good morning, Bruce.
My brain's a little slow this morning. I'm sorry for that.
Susie Jones, don't worry about it. Peg Webb, good to be with both of you ladies. Hey, to both of you and to listeners, I want to apologize in advance. If I cough in your ear or if I lose my voice. So almost everybody I know, I don't know about you guys, but almost everybody I know from late November through December, through the holidays, through most of the month of January, everybody had something, the crud. My wife, Pamela, went through a cycle of antibiotics. She went through a cycle of Paxlovid because she got COVID. And through it all, I didn't catch anything. I was feeling pretty cocky, but it finally caught up to me this week, and I have the crud. So I apologize in advance if I cough in your ear.
We forgive you in advance.
Yes, we do. Knock on wood, I have not had anything yet.
I thought I was going to make it through. I thought, you know, we might be getting past most of it pretty soon. And I was a good boy. I got my flu shot. I got my COVID booster. I got vaccinated for pneumococcal pneumonia. I did all the things that us old people are supposed to do. So anyway, hopefully my voice will last through the show. Hey, Susie and listeners, Peg and I today, and Peg, I think it's a good topic, and we'll explain why we think it's a good topic. But we're going to today we thought we would talk about hedging inflation in your investment portfolio. And I know there are some people that are listening right now saying, but inflation's not bad right now. Inflation was bad, but it's come down. I think, you know, we measure it right now somewhere in the 2.5% range. And if I can put money in a safe account, in a bank deposit account, or in a money market, and I can make higher than the rate of inflation, if I can make 4 and inflation's 2.5, that's not a problem. But Peg, I'm getting the question, and I'm sure you are too, with the change in the administration, with the, you know, the swearing in of a new president and a new political party, and some of the stated things that this president wants to do, it has raised concerns that inflation might be coming back. So we'll talk a little bit about that, and then we'll talk about what we do if it does come back. Peg?
Yes. I agree with everything you said, Bruce, but I think what we'll do is just talk about inflation a little bit. What is it even? Well, it's actually a measurement of how quickly the prices for goods and services are rising. Now, we have a lot of media outlets that's telling us every day, this is costing more, this is costing more, this is costing more. And that happens to trickle down to all of us. A lot of the commodities that we use daily are food and energy. And so we watch those as part of the consumer price index. So people talk about the CPI. Well, that consumer price index is a measurement of all these goods and services that people like us that use so that we can see if things are going up or down. But generally, the way the industry kind of works is we want more of a moderate growth. And we want a healthy economy, but as the economy grows, productivity increases, but consumer demand goes up, and then prices rise. I have not forgot at all about the COVID era, right? All of a sudden, you know, COVID hit for us just worldwide, and talk about having now history of a global pandemic. And looking at inflation and how things cost. Well, one of the things that happens that creates high inflation is we have a lot of resources or money globally around the world. And when COVID hit, the government actually printed a lot of money. And so if you create more money and that's available, then things start to grow in cost. And you know, I know for some of you out there listening, that may not all make sense. But if you think of, if you want to go buy something, let's say a bike, you know, maybe it's an electric bike. And there's just thousands and thousands of these bikes at every store that you could possibly go to. Well, you can negotiate probably the price of that, what you want to pay, because there's you have so many choices. But if those same bikes, there was only a few on the shelf and you wanted that bike, then you're willing to pay more because you wanted or needed. Now, a bike is an example, but it could be eggs. It could be bread. It could be, you know, something that you actually need to live. So inflation is really a measurement of how much consumers are paying for things. So it is a big deal because the Fed keeps their eye on it because they do all sorts of you know, surveys and things to see if people feel like things are costing more. And they correlate it with, I talked about food, consumer consumption. But then we have to talk about what are our earnings? All the people that out there that are working, are they getting the same pay or are they getting more to keep up with inflation? Because we all have to buy those goods and services, number one, to live. So I wanted to give kind of that foundation, Bruce, as just a basis for a start.
Yeah, and I think that's great. And I think you're right. I think we throw these terms around like inflation, and we assume that everybody knows what we're talking about, but maybe not everybody does. And Ben, to that point, and again, we have talked about this on the show before, but I don't think we can talk about it too often. We can say, in fact, I just did a few minutes ago, that inflation right now is somewhere around 2.5%, which is not horrible. But even at 2.5%, that means that we are losing purchasing power. If prices overall on goods and services are increasing at a rate of 2.5% a year, we can say that that's low right now, but there's a cumulative effect if that keeps happening every year. And like what we went through a few years ago, like in 2022, I think inflation was at like 9%. So inflation didn't stop, it just slowed down. It's not 9.5% anymore, it's only 2.5%. But prices are still rising, and people are still paying for the increase that they went through in 2022. So if a basket of goods and services in 2020 cost you $100, today those same goods and services, that same trip to the grocery store might be $125. And like you said, earnings did not necessarily keep up. So people are feeling squeezed. And it's one of the big contributing factors to why President Trump won the election. People felt the effects of inflation. It's the economy, stupid. And they felt we were headed in the wrong direction and we needed to change. And the other point I wanted to make, and again, it's one that we've made on the show before. You and I have talked about this a lot. During that same period of time where inflation was high, the stock market also did well. So I would tell people, look, I know it feels bad because you're paying more, a lot more for your eggs at the grocery store, but what happened to your 401k plan in the last few years? But two things, and now I'm arguing with myself. Number one, that retirement plan money might not be available to you to use right now to go buy your eggs because it's in your retirement plan and you're not 59 and a half and you're not retired yet. So, yeah, it looks great to see your statement on paper and your 401k getting bigger, but you don't have access to that money. And number two, and this was pointed out to me by actually a relative of mine, what if you're someone that doesn't have any discretionary income and you can't put money into your retirement plan? It's great for you, Bruce, to talk about, oh, look at your retirement plan, look at the stock market. But I'm trying to buy groceries from paycheck to paycheck, and I don't have any extra money, and this feels awful to me. So it is not lost on me the impact that inflation has on people. And if it's affecting some people in our society, ultimately it's going to affect all of us. Okay?
Yeah, that was all very good information, because I agree with 100% that you said. The headlines in the news today are some of the things that President Trump is, you know, is promising, and promising in cutting taxes and, in his words, kind of cutting regulatory red tape, giving the economy the optimism. But one thing we haven't talked about a lot on this show is these tariffs and these imports and the raising prices. So if we go and we want to change things, our relationship monetary-wise with all these different countries and the goods and services that we're getting from them, and trying to decrease the amount of money that we pay and get the prices better for us. So the first thing everybody's saying is, well, if that's the case, then you're just going to raise the price somewhere else. And I kind of believe in that, right? I don't know where we're squeezing everything to make this all work, but that's just something that is driving the idea of more inflation that may bring. We haven't done this for a while with the tariffs, so I think that's something that we have to watch. And then just the immigration restrictions on have just raised some alarms about some labor shortages. And, you know, if we do have the immigration restrictions go the way Trump would like to, you know, how does that come into play? So just lots of things. We don't have the answers for all of that. But what we can do is help our clients with trying to build an inflation-proof portfolio. And I would say in my 40 years doing this, a good inflation has always been a well-diversified stock portfolio. These stocks, these America's best companies, international companies, they tend to persevere no matter what, you know, who the president is, what's happening around them. They're very quick to adapt. And so owning, if you can afford to own, you know, stocks, that has always kept up with inflation so far. Well, I have a lot of clients that over the years came in, Bruce, with their land, because, you know, based in Minnesota at the time, they their land was so valuable and it was going up. And then people would come in and say, the land is the only thing that's kept up with inflation. Well, when you compare, you know, raw land with the stock market, the question is, maybe it's close. But that, in my mind, would be a second close thing where you have something that's real, like land. And then other things are commodities. So you've got commodities like oil and things that are they're not something that you can buy forever, right? They're kind of a certain amount of it. Well, that's going to drive the price up. And then also real estate. In our entire careers, Bruce, we've talked about real estate as part of your portfolio. Now, I could include land in there. I'm thinking more of like houses, and maybe you're buying commercial buildings, or these are things that people in our space where we have helped people talk about, well, what percentage should you own in, you know, real estate? And then also there's just when it comes to stocks, you know, something that historically, and this would be my opinion, is dividend paying stocks. If that's something that you could maybe live off the dividend, the growth of those stocks have continued to grow. So it actually gives you kind of two things. It gives you some income off of your portfolio, and the baseline value of those stocks over time have continued to go up. So a well-diversified portfolio in all the things that I talked about it are a way to keep up with things that are costing. Bruce?
Yeah, I like you did a nice transition where, you know, we started out talking about inflation. What is it? And is it going to reoccur? And we concluded we don't know for sure. You know, there's disagreement even from economists that if the new president is able to implement what he wants to implement, if that will have an inflationary effect or not. So we don't know, but in case it might happen, we're saying, here's what you can do in advance. Here's how you can protect against it. And Peg, it occurs to me that this is kind of the, I don't want to I started off by saying this is a really good topic. Now, again, it sounds like I'm arguing with myself. This is what we tell people all the time, whether we think there's going to be high inflation or not, that we want you to be diversified. And some people, I think they think as they get older or as they retire, they have to reduce their risk. And when they say that, what they really mean is risk of principal, having investments that can depreciate or retract in value, like stocks can. So they think, I got to get out of stocks. I got to reduce my risk. But risk of principal is only one of many risks. A bigger risk in my mind is losing purchasing power. What if my return on all of my money is lower than the rate of inflation? So even though I didn't lose any principal, I can't buy as much as prices increase, which they will do over my lifetime. So a diversified portfolio, including exposure to stocks, is always a good idea. It's just a question of how much of the portfolio should be in stocks, and that probably changes as we get older and where interest rates are and where inflation rates are. We can adapt. We can make adjustments to the percentage of exposure to stocks, but almost always, almost everybody should have some exposure to stocks, no matter how conservative you are, no matter how old you are, because historically, stocks have been our best defense mechanism against inflation or against rising prices. The other one that comes up a lot, Peg, and I'll let you comment on this one also, but it seems like when we have inflation or we have fears of inflation, suddenly we get bombarded with these commercials about buying gold or some other precious metal, gold or silver. And I always tell people, look, as part of your portfolio, a diversified portfolio, like Peg said, exposure to gold and silver and other precious metals is not a bad idea, but I have people that literally want to sell everything and put all their money into gold or some precious metal. And I remind them that historically, as an asset class, that has not done as well as stocks have. And in fact, with gold specifically, there was once a 27-year period of time where the price of gold was underwater. If you bought gold, I think it was like 1980, and I don't remember what the price per ounce was, but gold prices plummeted in the 80s and didn't get back to the same price until 2007. Well, stocks have never been underwater for 27 years. So this idea that this gold is the saver to protect us against inflation, just not correct. Historically, that's wrong. And again, I'm not saying zero gold. I'm saying not all gold. Some gold and silver as part of a portfolio may make sense. But Peg said it best. Real estate, commodities, gold and silver, stocks, bonds, cash. We want you well diversified. But if you're going to inflation-proof your portfolio, Peg, it has to include some exposure to stocks.
Yeah, and I think, you know, now is a really good time to look at your entire portfolio and see, maybe do a deep dive, or if your financial advisor at Own Wealth Enhancement Group does this, and we have a huge investment department on our roundtable. But if you're doing it by yourself or you haven't met with your advisor for a while, just to make sure that you're well diversified, because I would agree that we're in a time right now where there's a lot of, I feel like there could be some change. And I feel positive in these changes, meaning you should be diversified in lots of different things. So one of the things that our investment team does is just to make sure that you have all sorts of different asset types, but most importantly, that if you have those asset types, that you rebalance, that you just don't hold on. Because I'm finding now that people love these tech stocks, right? They love them because they've done so well, but yet is it time to rebalance and maybe sell off some of all those profits with that tech stock and go into something maybe like a dividend paying stock? You don't have to leave the stock market, but it would be diversifying. And if you have too much stock, then maybe you should buy, and if you're afraid of inflation, maybe you look at Treasury inflation protection bonds. There's still bonds out there with a Treasury, even a fixed rate or an inflation protection bond. Treasuries issue all the time, and they're on the secondary market. So bottom line is look at your portfolio and look at rebalancing, but then where should you position some of your other money in? Because people love to stay with the winners, right? The race is won so long with these certain stocks. At what point do you say, I need to rebalance? I've got too much of this one thing.
Yeah. Hey, Susie, I know we're close to time for a break, but I'm going to suggest we do this. Peg just brought up a really interesting concept. And Peg, maybe after the break, you can explain it in more detail. You brought up rebalancing, and I think that's a critically important thing to bring up. I'm glad you did, but we probably don't have time to fully explain it now. But we'll come back after the break. Peg will explain rebalancing. We'll maybe have a couple of other final thoughts on this topic. And then we'll absolutely get as many listener questions in the second half of the show as we can. Susie?
All right, very good. Remember, you are listening to Your Money. The phone number to call right now if you're listening and have a question or a comment, 651-461-9226. Again, I'll say it slower, 651-461-9226. The topic of conversation today, hedging inflation in your portfolio rebalancing. That's what we're going to talk about next. 651-461-9226. If you have a question about what you should do with your money, back after this. Welcome back to the second half of Your Money. I'm Susie Jones, along with Bruce Helmer and Peg Webb. Bruce, of course, the founder of Wealth Enhancement and financial advisor. Peg Webb, financial advisor, senior vice president. Welcome back to both of you. We're talking before the break about rebalancing. Peg and Bruce, does a person, if they have a financial advisor, whether it's you or someone else, does the individual have to initiate it? Would I have to call my office of my financial advisor and say, hey, I heard this show. Will you please rebalance my portfolio? Can you start with that and then get into more about what you wanted to talk about?
Thank you, Susie Jones. Hey, Peg, that's a nice segue. We wanted to expand a little bit on explaining rebalancing, but then the question is, do you have to be proactive and tell your advisor you want to rebalance, or is your advisor and your advisory firm going to do that automatically? Peg, tell listeners what we mean by rebalancing.
Yeah, so rebalancing, and I'm just going to make a very simplistic example of stocks and bonds. So let's pretend you have 50% of your savings in the stock market, and you have 50% of your savings in bonds. Maybe it's treasuries, maybe it's municipal bonds, that kind of thing. Well, each of those two different asset classes will perform differently at different times. Well, the last 3 years, for sure, we have had huge gains on our stocks. So if I have 50% in the stock market and now I earned 30% over the last 3 years, my 50% of that portfolio now went to maybe 70% in the stock market because of all that gain. And I only have 30% in bonds, treasuries or municipals or cash in the bank, that kind of thing. So that's dramatic. So if you want to get back to the original 50-50, that would warrant you would sell off or take your profits of 20% of the stock market to get back to that 50-50. So that cash that's coming off the stock market sales would go into some type of fixed cash, CDs, municipal bonds, treasuries, anything that's more income oriented. So I gave that dramatic example because that is a recent example that happened. Now, you might be more diversified than just stocks and bonds. You might have real estate, you might have commodities, you might have alternatives, things like that. So what I have always suggested in the help of Wealth Enhancement Group's roundtable, you know, they do the rebalancing within the portfolios for us as advisors. We can control, you know, how much we sell off, because a lot of people, when things are going well, they don't necessarily want to stop investing in that series of stocks that are going up. But you can't time it well either as far as the rebalancing. So it may not be as dramatic as I mentioned, the 20% off, selling off, you know, right away. But the other thing is if you have a stock in the portfolio of stocks that are doing really well and you're asking somebody to go buy a treasury for 4.5%, it feels dramatic. But it is necessary. So the other reason that people may not want to rebalance is if it's not in an IRA where you're sheltered from annual taxes, then that would be a taxable event. So we also look at what are the tax consequences of you rebalancing. And then it might justify, too, with going through that rebalancing that you incorporate in something else in your portfolio with that cash versus just going to bonds. So the last word here is it doesn't have to be an automatic, although a lot of companies will put on, you know, you can check a box that says, I want to rebalance. And then it's just actively rebalancing to the percentages that you had. We take a little bit different approach in that we want to make sure that we're not just moving and shaking in that portfolio that much, but we monitor when do we really want to make those changes based on what we see coming up in the future when it comes to the markets, both on the stock market side and the fixed income side. Bruce?
Yeah, I think the only thing I would add, that was a really good explanation, Peg, of rebalancing. You know, I think everybody in our industry would agree that rebalancing makes sense. Exactly when you should do it and how you should do it, maybe nobody agrees on, and everybody does it a little bit differently. So it's not going to be an exact science. As Peg mentioned, you may have to take tax consequences into consideration. And it does seem counterintuitive, right? Here comes your advisor. You've got this stock or this sector or this asset class like technology that's doing fantastic. And then we come along and say, we think you should have less of that. And you're like, what? Why would I have less? It's doing great. But yet, on another level, we also should understand buy low and sell high. And if that sector or that asset class has done well and it's high and you can sell and lock in those gains and go buy something else that might be cheap right now, you're selling high, buying low. That's what rebalancing helps us to do. But it does feel, I'm sure, oftentimes to the investor, like it's counterintuitive. Why would I do that? But yet, if you really think about it, it actually does make sense in the long run. Peg, final thought, key takeaways for people in terms of you know, building a portfolio to protect yourself against inflation, you know, hedging your bet. In the first half of the show, we talked about, you know, the reasons we think inflation might come back. We don't know for sure. What is it? How does it impact you? Not sure if it'll come back or not, but if it does, here's some things you can do. Final thoughts, key takeaways before we take questions the rest of the way. Peg?
Yeah, some final thoughts are modest inflation on its own is not necessarily bad for investors. I would say personally, what I see is groceries are high, airline tickets are high, and dining out is high. Those are kind of things I'm saying, wow, that's much more than it was a year ago. And so when we look at investment portfolios, inflation is not terrible, but we just don't want to go back to that 9%. Sustained high levels of inflation are not good, because when we talk about this definition, that we talk about this real rate of return, and we call it real rate of return because let's say you earned 6% on your portfolio, but inflation is 4. You really only earned a net 2. So when we run financial plans at Wealth Enhancement Group, we include an inflationary percentage every single year. And it shows us what your net is of what your earnings are. And that is your earnings on your investments minus inflation. So we are creating these plans to be able to keep enough money compounding so that you can be able to afford the goods and services as they go up with inflation. I talked about rebalancing, and I know it's very difficult to not want to change your plan based on what the stocks are doing or what the bonds are doing and having a knee-jerk reaction. So another final thought is if you create a plan, and I hope you do, that you stick with it and you don't derail yourself, because that's so hard to make up. If you miss the highest high, you know, and if you didn't include enough inflation in your financial plan. So lastly, you know, if this seems all foreign to you and it's difficult, we recommend that you get help. You know, contact somebody, contact financial advisor, and make sure it's a comprehensive financial plan planning firm. Because I still see a lot of people that just want to transact and buy something because somebody told them that this was what to buy. I would wish and hope that people would take a much grander look at their portfolio and incorporate everything in, not only investments, but, you know, how are you going to plan for the rest of your life? And I think it's really important now that we have this transition of President Trump, what's going to happen, you know, create some type of longer term plan to make sure that you can keep up with inflation, because that's going to be the key to your future.
Yeah, good summation, Peg. Susie, I'm ready to segue the show to questions, and we'll definitely get listeners involved. But I'm going to ask the first question. I'm going to ask Peg, because, Peg, this is one that I'm getting from a lot of people that I encounter, not only clients and prospects in meetings, but just in everyday life. We've talked a lot on the show about the fact that the tax cuts under the first administration a decade ago are set to expire by law at the end of 2025, and we were speculating the taxes were on sale and the taxes might go up again, and there were planning opportunities that we were using and advising our clients on in anticipation of this potential tax increase at the end of 2025. Now that Trump has won re-election, do you have a sense or do you have a feeling of, are they going to extend the tax cuts? Are they going to make even lower? Are we still planning under the assumption that taxes might go up for many people going forward? Or do you even have an opinion about that? Are you getting that question? Because I'm getting it a lot. Peg?
Yeah, I'm getting it a lot too. And I don't, right now it's still hard to see what's going to happen. But there's many things that we coach people on every single day. And one that's kind of top for me is, you know, there's so many dollars in these IRAs that people have tax deferred for decades of time. And the markets have been so good. We did get this question. We weren't able to answer it a couple weeks ago. You know, does it make sense to take some of that IRA taxable money and convert it to Roth for my beneficiaries? You know, if we do believe that taxes are going to be a little bit lower, and even if it's a little bit lower, it may be time just to look at converting some of that taxable IRA to Roth. The other reason I say that is because if you can get, you know, your taxable money into a tax-free for the future, you may still have decades of time, but at least the beneficiaries will get tax-free money. And then there's the second top one for me is the lifetime exclusion. So if you die, you know, before January of 2026, you have a big pool as a married couple of $28 million that you can die with. And so it's going to sunset somewhere to $14 million. And I know the percentage of people out there that have that kind of wealth are very small compared to, you know, the grand percentage out there. But how would that affect you? I've actually seen clients gifting to their children now, not necessarily because of this rule that may change. They're just starting to feel more wealthy and they want to share their money with their children now versus they feel like they're going to live in their 90s and they'd rather see them not struggle today and they'd rather see them, you know, go to a great college for a grandchild, that kind of thing. So those are the two observations I have, Bruce.
Yeah, the only thing I would add is we don't know for sure, to those of you that are asking that question, if tax rates will stay the same, go up or go down in the future. We don't know. But I would say this. What I do know is that right now, taxes are at historical lows for most people. And that doesn't mean, you know, that they, even though I don't know what will happen in 2026 and beyond, I do know that compared to where history has had tax rates, rates are low right now. So I still think those same planning opportunities that we've talked to people about in terms of doing a Roth conversion or selling assets and paying capital gains tax now and so forth. I still think those strategies can make sense just based on where we've been historically. The other thing that always comes into play when you have this discussion is the federal debt and deficit. And, you know, there's always the debate if we cut taxes, does it increase the deficit? But the other argument is that no, it doesn't, because if we cut tax rates, there's less wealthy people taking their money out of the country and offshoring and agreeing to pay the taxes, and or people make more money on their jobs, more people are in the workforce, and we make up for it that way. And so we don't. The answer is we don't know for sure. All we can do is plan for the way things are right now. And I think from a historical perspective, I would still say taxes are low, and there may be opportunities to go ahead. And like we always say, Peg, when we do tax planning or strategic financial planning, we're not looking at just lowering the taxes in the current tax year. We hope we're doing strategies that lower taxes over your lifetime, which may mean you pay a little bit more tax in the short term so that you pay a lot less in the long term. So on all these things, what's going to happen with inflation? What's going to happen with the you know, Tax Cut and Job Act of a decade ago? All these things will become apparent as the year goes on and President Trump gets further into his second term. And we will talk about all these things on the show as we have more clarity. Susie, have we got questions from listeners?
Yeah, we have a question. This texter writes, how will the new brokerage tax in Minnesota affect services?
Peg, do you know what that reference is, the brokerage tax in Minnesota, what they're talking about?
No, I don't.
Can I say we're lucky right now because a colleague of mine is in studio, Blois Olson, who is keenly aware of everything going on at the legislature, and he said that is not going to happen. So that answers your question. Isn't that funny?
Yeah, I don't even know what that is. I have not heard that.
Okay.
I assume Blois is right. Blois is always right.
Blois is always right. How about that? He's going to just say hello real quick.
Good morning, Bruce. Peg, it's proposed in the governor's budget, but we have a long way between here and there.
Very good. Thank you for that. Good morning. A texter writes, I'm 73 years old. Just started taking RMDs from my 401k. Can I convert those dollars into a Roth rather than leaving them in a taxable account? Bruce, Peg?
What a good question. What a smart question. What a great listener to, you know, be thinking that. So, Peg, maybe explain again for some people that don't know how required minimum distribution works. And it's up to age 73. Now, a lot of people still get confused by that. They don't know that the age on that has changed. But then when I have to take required minimum distribution, can I still do Roth conversions? What a smart question. Peg?
Yeah, so 73 is the magic age now that you are required to mandatorily take money out of your IRAs. And so that's required minimum distribution, RMD. So in this case, and I get this question a lot, people would love to take that required minimum distribution. Let's just say, it's $3,000 that you have a RMD you have to take out. That particular $3,000 that you have to take out cannot be converted to a Roth. You have to pay your tax on that $3,000. Then you can look and see if you'd like to take some further distributions and do a Roth conversion. So let's say you have another $3,000 that you'd like to get out of your IRA. You then can do Roth conversion on that second $3,000, or can do a Roth conversion for a lot more than that. But what we do see is we try hard to get people to do those conversions before they turn 73, because that way you don't have to pay the tax on that required minimum distribution. Now, mind you, when I talk about doing an IRA to a Roth IRA conversion, you are going to pay taxes. But the beauty here is if you could get it, that money into a Roth, you know, for a good length of time, hopefully you'll see that compounding tax free versus leaving it in that IRA that's taxable, where you'll grow there as well, but you'll pay a lot more tax to get that out. Bruce?
Yeah, and I don't want to oversimplify this, Peg, but the best time to do Roth conversions for most people is when their taxable income is the lowest. And oftentimes that is after you've retired and you're not making a paycheck anymore, and maybe you haven't started to draw your Social Security benefits yet. So you have a lot of control over what your taxable income is because there's no paycheck, there's no automatic Social Security, and you might have very low taxable income. Those are the years we might come in and say, let's soak up this low bracket that you're in. Maybe you're in a 10% federal bracket, and we can take money out of this IRA at 10 cents on the dollar and shift it to a Roth where there's no future taxes due. But I agree with you. I think that was the main point that you made. If you wait until required minimum distribution, not that you can't do it, not that it won't work, but I think ideally that's probably not the best or most productive time. Susie, can we squeeze in one more?
Well, I have a question. What's the age of RMD?
Yeah, Peg just talked about that, 73.
73.
But Peg, that's going to be adjusted again, Peg. I don't remember how and when the adjustment works.
Yeah, I don't have that in front of me, but there's a table where it just incrementally gets a little bit higher and higher. But a couple of weeks ago, too, we had a 91-year-old ask if he was too old that we didn't get on air to do this conversion. And you can absolutely do it at 91 years old. And so people just want to get it out of their IRA. They're in a lower tax bracket. Why not put it in a better position for the beneficiaries?
Okay. So
yeah, Susie.
Go ahead, guys.
So it starts at 73, and the percentage at 73 is around 4% of the total, or just under. But as you get older, that percentage gets higher because it's just a mortality calculation. So the older you get, the more the government wants you to withdraw, and the more taxes you're going to have to pay. And that's a whole nother plan opportunity.
I was going to say, why is there even an RMD? But I think you just alluded to it.
Uncle Sam wants to collect their taxes that they've been waiting on those tax deferred plans for all those years.
Oh, dear. They'll get it one way or another, won't they?
Yeah, and if you don't take it out, they'll get it from your heirs when they inherit.
I was just going to say, hey, good to talk to you guys this week. Great show. We learned a lot. Thanks for all of your great information. And if you're listening and you had a question, you can always email it to yourmoney@wealthenhancement.com, or you can call this number 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 1-888-6-ADVICE, 1-888-6-ADVICE. Make it a great day.